This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Since 1988, Whitetail Institute has been perfecting annual and perennial seed products specifically for hunters who plant food plots. Their seeds have been engineered to be palatable, high in protein, and extremely attractive to deer. Whether you live in the Deep South or Midwest farm country, they have products that will help you grow your best food plot yet. For more information about their seeds and their blends, visit whitetailinstitute.com. Enter the discount code SE15 for 15% off.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Wing and Tail Boys podcast, your Northeast hunting and fishing destination. I'm Chris.
And I'm Angelo.
And we're your hosts. Join us as we navigate the woods and waters of the Northeast, sharing our passion for the outdoors.
Whether it's land management, outdoor recreation, hunting, or fishing, we're going to cover it all. With 40 plus years of experience in the Northeast, we'll provide insights, tips, and stories to help you make the most of your adventures and help you experience the wild.
So, tune in, grab your gear, and let's hit the woods together. And always remember, success is just a commitment away.
What's going on, ladies and gentlemen? Thank you for joining us here for another episode of the Wing and Tail Outdoors Podcast. Today's episode brings you another Northeastern Hunter Snapshot series showcasing Jeremy Martin of Western Pennsylvania. To give you a little bit of an overview of what the episode entails, Jeremy grew up in Western Pennsylvania, joined the Marines, came back, joined an oil company, and basically bounced around from Pennsylvania to Ohio to Kentucky, back to Pennsylvania. He's hunted mountainous terrain. He's hunted flatland. Essentially all the different types of terrain or hunting habitat that you'll find in the Northeast and also in other regions of the country. So in this episode, we talk about Jeremy's upbringing in hunting, how he got into hunting. He didn't come from a hunting family, so those are always really interesting stories to learn. He had a mentor early in his early years, as most of us have. And over time, he began to develop his own hunting style. And throughout developing that hunting style, he's been able to find success in all different states, in all different terrains. And today's episode is talking about what he did or how he progressed as a hunter from his early years to now and was able to find success, what tactics he has used to help find success in these different terrains, but also different things that he learned along the way that maybe are different, things that are the same, and stuff like that. It was a really great episode. I really enjoyed sitting down. Jeremy had a lot of great information to share, and we've already communicated about possibly doing another episode together. So once again, it was a really exciting episode. I want to thank you so much for joining us here and taking the time out of your day to listen to us kind of talk hunting for a day. Before we get into this episode, please remember, if you're in the market for a mobile setup this year, you got to make sure you're checking out the Nested Tree Stand System. The Nested Tree Stand System is one of a kind. It is the only thing of its kind that I've seen to date, where essentially the backpack, the sticks, the stand, they all go together to make a frame pack that puts all of the weight on your hips and makes 20 pounds feel like 10. The rails, they use rails instead of climbing sticks. So it's not one stick, one straight stick going on the tree. It's a rail which means your foot, your whole 2 feet can fit on one step together. Those rails fit perfectly around the backpack, and the backpack straps to the harness that is attached to the platform, which then creates the entire frame pack. The model that I had, that I got, comes with the one stick aiders. And I went ahead, as you guys know, I love DIY. So I went ahead and added a second step to the bottom of mine. Either way, great tree stand system, great product, definitely worth your consideration. And if you're interested in checking out that product and you see something that you like, feel free to use the website that is found in the description, down at the bottom of the description for this episode. And also you can use the discount code U10 for 10% off of your order. And using that code also helps this podcast out. Again, I want to thank you guys so much for joining us here for another episode of the Wing and Tail Outdoors podcast, where success is always a commitment away. Until next week, ladies and gentlemen, enjoy, have a great week, and we'll see you next time.
Wing and Tail Boys podcast is brought to you by Truthsticks Custom Arrows. Built with FireKnock technology, Truthsticks Custom Arrows simply fly flatter, spin faster, and improve arrow efficiency downrange. With two signature arrows for the compound bow and a signature crossbow bolt, they've got something for everyone. If you're ready to take the guesswork out of archery and take the best performing arrow into the field, then check out Truthsticks Custom Arrows at wingandtailoutdoors.com and experience the truth of arrow flight.
What is going on, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome back to another episode of the Wing and Tail Outdoors podcast. On today's episode, we are joined by Jeremy Martin of X-Ring Custom Arrows, and we're going to be talking all about Jeremy today. We're going to learn a little bit about who he is, his progression through hunting, how he likes to hunt, and the tactics that he uses to find some success. So, Jeremy, how are you doing today, man?
Oh, not too bad. How about you?
Listen, I could be doing better, but ain't nobody going to listen to me complain, right?
That's right. Ain't no sense in it.
Yeah, ain't that the truth? So we had a really cool conversation here over the last, I don't know, half hour before we started recording, where we were talking a whole bunch of arrow setups and all that good stuff. It's always a great time talking to you. But for the listeners who don't know who you are or don't know anything about you, can you give just a quick baseball stat card of who Jeremy Martin is?
All right. Well, I'm Jeremy Martin. I grew up in Southwest Pennsylvania. Mountains are real close, so I did a lot of mountain hunting when I was young. At the age of 19, I joined the Marine Corps. I was there for about 5 years. Well, I was there for 5 years, got out, came back home, found a job, had to move for it. And 20 years later, I'm back home. I hunt pretty much mostly whitetail and elk. I'm venturing into some firearms and bear, but mostly with a stick and a string and sitting in a tree stand somewhere.
Okay. Right up our alley here, man. So when you got your job and you had to move away, were you still in PA or did you leave? Did you move to a different area? What was that about?
When I started with the company that I currently work for, I started in New Jersey. So I was right on the New Jersey, Pennsylvania line. Anybody knows, any of your listeners are from like the Lambertville, New Jersey area. That's where I started my career outside of the military. I was there for about 8 months. No offense to the New Jersey folks, but I had enough. I can't handle jug handles on the highways. And I took a job promotion and I moved down to Kentucky. I was there for about 6.5 years. Lots of good hunting down in Kentucky. Moved to Athens, Ohio. Was there for about 5 years. And then moved up to Northern Ohio, which is about 20 miles west of Akron. I was there for 5 years or so. I think I probably have some numbers off, but in all, this is my 20th year with the company, and I'm back home in Fayette County, Pennsylvania.
Okay. So for the record, I am an ex-New Jersey resident, born and raised. And literally from the time I was 15 years old, I told all my friends, family, anyone who would listen, I was getting out and I was never coming back. I went to college here in Pennsylvania. I went to East Stroudsburg University, graduated, moved to New Hampshire for 2 years, came back to Jersey for a few years because COVID and all that nonsense and some family stuff. And then married my wife, my current wife now, and we moved out here to PA last year, and we started to put some roots down, which is really
nice. Exciting.
So what do you do for work? Like, what do you, outside of X-Ring Customs, what's your job?
Yeah, X-Ring Custom Arrows is just my... to fuel the addiction of the outside. So
okay.
My day job that pays all my bills is I work for a natural gas company. So we're gas transmission. We don't own. We have pipe from Nova Scotia all the way down into Mexico.
Wow.
Well, the Texas-Mexico border. So we pump high pressure gas up and down, you know, pretty much the heart of America, you know, anywhere from Texas up through Arkansas and Mississippi and Tennessee, Kentucky, Ohio, Pennsylvania, out into New Jersey, and then all the way up into Maine. So, right.
Okay, that's different. You're the first oil conglomerate we've had on the podcast. So, out of Kentucky, New Jersey, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, what was your favorite state to hunt?
I really liked Kentucky. Just while I was there, I was younger and gaining access. The county that I lived in was notorious for big deer. Like notorious, and getting permission was like act of Congress, and there was no public land around me, which made it really hard to hunt. So I had a couple little pockets that I could hunt that like I never really produced anything worth talking about. But all my buddies who had been born and raised in that county, and you know, they're coming in, you know, second week of archery season, show me pictures of deer that are 180 inches, and I'm like drooling all over myself. So. That kind of, I really like that. I liked Kentucky for that. But Ohio and Southern Ohio, where I first lived, it was probably, that's where I had most of my success with, I call them big deer because I'm from Pennsylvania. If you talk to an Ohioan, they're just, they're a mediocre deer. But for me, they tripped my trigger. So they wasn't allowed to walk around anymore.
That's fair.
All so right. I'd have to say Southern Ohio was, it's probably my favorite place to hunt. Lots of good memories there.
Now, I can't imagine that Southern Ohio is significantly far from where you are now in southwestern Pennsylvania. So do you ever go back to where, you know, Ohio, where you were?
Actually, when I moved to north central Ohio, I traveled back down. It was 3.5 hours. I would travel all the way down to Southern Ohio and hunt every year. And that's where I did the vast majority of my hunting. In Ohio was down there. When I was up in the northern part of Ohio, there was very little public land. And what was there, there was lots of boot tracks everywhere. But I would go out just to get in the woods. And I enjoyed that too. But Southern Ohio was definitely where I spent the majority of my time during hunting season.
Okay. So talk to me a little bit about your earlier years. What was it like growing up? I'm trying to, don't hate me. I'm doing the math here. And if you were 17, 18 in the early 90s, then that puts you as a 70s baby, yeah?
No, I was born in 80. Okay. Yeah, so I'm 45. I had to think about that for a second. Alzheimer's is already kicking in.
Sorry about that. Okay. So talk to me about what it was like growing up as a hunter in the 80s, early 90s. Were you part of a hunting family? Was your family big on hunting, or was it kind of just something that you kind of got the itch for? Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I played sports. I played mostly baseball when I was young, like little league, stuff like that. And once I got up into middle school, probably seventh grade, I met my neighbor, and he was out in his yard shooting his bow. And I was like, because I would always get up on Saturday mornings. You don't know anything about TNN and all that when all the good hunting shows was on TV. But I would get up and I'd watch all that, all the hunting, all the fishing. I'd watch everything. And I'd fished for, you know, since I was probably 12 years old with friends. My family's not hunters or fishermen. So I'm the black sheep of the family. So I just kind of hooked on to my neighbor's coattails, and he started me, you know, just shooting in the backyard. And then I started into shooting 3D shoots and indoor leagues in the wintertime. And then next year, hunting season came around, and I sat in a tree stand, and I didn't kill anything that year. The first year, second year came around, I killed my first deer with a bow, and that's all I was allowed to have. My parents didn't really like having guns because I had two younger siblings, and them not being in the outdoors, they didn't frown upon it, but they just said no. So I had a couple bows, and that's all I did was bow hunts. So the second year I killed my first deer, and from there on out I was hooked. So I spent every fall all the way up until I left for the Marine Corps in 99. I was in a tree somewhere.
I gotcha. Mm-hmm. Obviously in the 80s, there's no internet. There's no, well, hold on a second. You said you started, how old are you? About 13, 14 when you started?
Yeah. So like early 90s.
Okay. So early 90s, cell phones are just really getting big, right?
Yeah. That was never a thing.
internet comes around late 90s, mid to late 90s. People don't really have the internet in their homes until 98, 99, 2000, which is, you know, now we're talking, I'm 8, 9 years old. My family's got AOL dial-up. Right. Yeah. So now you're this young kid. You're looking to, all of a sudden you got this fire up your ass. You want to get out in the woods. You want to start hunting. Right. You love archery. How are you gathering knowledge or skill on how to become a better hunter? There's no podcast. There's no internet. There's no YouTube. How are you learning?
Well, if my parents were sitting on either side of me right now, they'd sit here and tell you how many times I got in trouble for being at the bow shop too late because I sat at a bow shop and I listened to the, I call them old timers, but they weren't really old timers. They were my age. Yeah. You know, they were in their 40s, their 50s.
Well, they're old timers now.
Yeah. And just listening to them. And, you know, I picked up a pile of knowledge just by sitting here listening. And I did it for, my hours and days and weeks on end, you know, and then I became friends with one of the shop owner's kids. Me and him became really tight. So like summertime, my parents like lost me because I was gone. I was at the bow shop every single day from open to close. I was, you know, behind the counter selling stuff, building arrows, you know, putting sights on, rests on, stuff like that, just helping out and just gathering as much knowledge as I possibly could.
All right. And what about your neighbor? Like, obviously your neighbors who got you into archery in the first place and target shooting and all that stuff. Was your neighbor also a hunter? Was he into hunting?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Right. I hunt with him. I still hunt with him to this day, every year.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
He would make a trip from Pennsylvania. Now he lives 15-ish minutes away. He would make a trip out to Southern Ohio. I would take vacation and we would hunt. Typically, the last week of October we spent in the woods for probably 8 years and never missed it. Rain, snow, hot, cold, it didn't matter. We were sitting in a tree stand.
For sure.
And we both had lots of success on the farm that we was able to hunt. Unfortunately, last year we lost that farm due to some shady deals, but we lost the lease. Sounds but it is what it is. Yeah. Life goes on and, sure. We're on the hunt for some, we're on the hunt for some more Ohio property that I don't have to remortgage my house for, sure. Which is really hard to find. Him and I have, all the way through the Marine Corps, when I got my job, you know, with back then it was Duke Energy, we've stayed in contact. We've hunted. We haven't done as much fishing, as I would like to do, you know, cause that was, we did a lot of trout fishing up here in the mountain and him and I haven't got to do that, in a really long time, but yeah, we still talk to this day. I talked to him, matter of fact, a couple weeks ago.
Yep. That's awesome. That's awesome, man. When you have those long-standing relationships, and you made a good, you had said something just now where you said, you know, you haven't gotten to fish as much as you would have liked to over the last few years, you know, and I know you are now engaged and you have a couple kids and it's like, I am just starting that. I'm only married now for 2 years and change. Our daughter is only three months and a couple weeks old, you know, and we went into it with the intention of, oh, our life isn't going to change that much. You know, yeah, you know, we're going to have a kid. Care of, and we're gonna have to take turns on who gets to do what. Mm-hmm. But dude, like, life has hit a fucking wall.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I didn't
hit you in the face.
It really does, you know. And where I used to shoot almost every day, I don't have that luxury anymore. Or where I used to be able to take the time to go out and scout, I don't have that anymore. So now life is changing and I feel like I need to be more efficient with less time. Which 100%. Is where I'm honestly struggling a little bit.
Right.
You know, we'll get into that here in a little bit.
Yeah. 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 We'll get into that with my new hunting addiction. We can get into that.
Yeah. So talk to me a bit about what hunting was like in those early years. You know, you're a new dude. You're out here. All you're doing is listening to people telling stories. You're a young kid, wet behind the ears. You're going out into the woods. What did your scouting look like? What did your tactics look like, or lack thereof, in the early days?
Very much lack thereof. You know, the first couple years, I completely and 100% relied on my neighbor. my buddy Ron, you know, love him to death. You know, he's like my second dad, but I completely relied on him. You know, I had my own thoughts in my head, but I kept them to myself because I was a kid, you know, and I completely 100% wholeheartedly knew that he was going to put me in a tree to kill a deer. That's not, he wasn't putting me in his prime time spots
Course not.
for mature bucks. And here in Southwest Pennsylvania, back in the day, Southwestern Pennsylvania buck was, you killed 120 inch deer, you killed a giant. You're riding around with him in the bed of your pickup truck for
Of
days.
course, yeah.
But I relied on him mostly to just, you know, to guide me and steer me in the right direction. And I would ask the questions, you know, like, why are we, are we going here instead of over there? Or, you know, why on this side of the creek and not that side of the creek? So I was constantly asking questions. He probably wanted to rip my head off a few times because so many questions I asked. I was worse than his kids are a lot younger, not a lot younger than me. They're probably your age. So we kind of, when Josh got old enough, you know, and all three of us started hunting together, it was like my education level went up because I was always the scared to ask questions, where his son was just like rapid fire. And you know, I gained a pile of knowledge that way. But as I got older, you know, 16, 17, got driver's license, was able to venture out on my own, I started to ask the questions, you know, so like, what do we do? And you know, why do you do this? And so that's kind of, I kind of like hunt a little bit on like the way he's always hunted. So you know, natural funnels, you know, on the way to a food source, you know, staging areas from bedding. And he was never on a field guy because we don't have that many fields in the mountains. We do now, but back then, you know, we hunted a lot of public land, and it was, you know, you got mountain laurel and rhododendrons, and you know, you find an oak flat and you found a gold mine. So that's pretty much, that's how I started.
Now, back in the day, I say back in the day very loosely because it's not all that long ago. Now that I'm only what 10 years younger than you, but back in the day when you're getting started, again, no YouTube, no internet, no Onyx or Spartan Forge or anything like that. If you were going to find success consistently, you needed to be a good woodsman. You needed to have those woodsmanship skills. Tell me a little bit about the woodsmanship that you learned earlier, or things that, talk to me a little bit about the early woodsmanship, whether you either learn them from your neighbor or your neighbor's child, or you just kind of started to figure it out on your own.
Right. So I guess I've learned a lot about him, you know, hunt high, hunt low, you know, what the wind kind of does in these times of the day, you know, for morning versus night, where the deer tend to be, because we got lots of, you know, mountains. So you don't get a whole lot of flats. So where you actually want to hunt on that mountainside, on the hillside, you know, and if you did find a flat, where you want to hunt on a flat. So it was just a lot of trial and error, honestly. Because once, like, he would put me in the area. Like he would say, Jeremy, here's this oak flat, and you pick your tree, you put your stand in it, and we'll go from there. So that's what I would do. So I would, and it, I did a lot of trial and error. I'd be like, all right, there's three or four does coming, and all of a sudden they hang up at 60 yards, and they look right at me. I'm like, how the hell do you see me?
Which is crazy
And
because people talk all the time about how deer don't see clearly. They don't see an HD during the day, but they sure as hell pick you off from a hell of a way out.
well, what I wasn't taking into account, that day that wind was hitting me from the back. You know, so it was blowing right in these deer's face. And I never worried about wind. I was like, I'm in the woods, I'm hunting, I get to see stuff, I don't care. But as time progressed, I learned to play the wind a little bit more during certain times of the year. You know, rut, it's kind of, it's a crapshoot where they're gonna come from, especially, you know, on the mountain. You know, whenever I was in Ohio, it was a little bit more predictable. You know where they're, you know where they like to go, to do their thing. So it was a little, it was a little different that in that aspect. But yeah, so most of it came from honestly trial and error, you know, and listening to the guys and trying to try to, like, as I was sitting in my tree stand, try to recall conversations that I remembered about, you know, hunting in Greene County or hunting, you know, up in Washington County. You know, just those old timers saying, you know, You don't have to worry about when I smoke a pack of cigarettes in a tree stand. So that was like in my head, like, and they would kill deer every year.
I mean, I know not that I condone this whatsoever, but I know old timers who literally tell me I ashed on a deer's back before I shot him. I don't condone it. It's kind of awful when you think about it, but you're right. So my question is for you, as far as scent is concerned, is did you not care about scent because you didn't know any better? Like people weren't talking about it, or were you naive, or were you naive in the sense that you said I can beat their nose?
No, I never said I can beat.
Which one was it for you? Early, it was never in the early years.
Yeah, it was never a beat the nose because that never even really rang. It was more of, it wasn't a super talked about thing, you know, like the scent blocker and scent lock and all that stuff was like, just, if I'm recalling correctly, it was really starting to kick off about then, you know, and you would see guys, you know, spray down with Santa Way or whatever they had at Walmart,
whatever
or the local bow shop had at the time, you know? And then, you know, as the years went on, when I say years, I mean like 1 or 2 years, I noticed my neighbor, my buddy, he would come out and he would have a big tote and he'd just throw it in the back of the truck. And he'd open that tote up whenever we got the tree stand to get dressed and it would smell like dirt. I was like, what the hell is he doing? And then I discovered those scent wafers. That was a game changer for me. I was like, yeah. So I had my parents bitching at me because of my bedroom smelled like dirt all the time. But as that, like, as that progressed, me paying attention to like what I washed my clothes in, you know, back then it was like baking soda and that was it. You know, I didn't, I was 15 years old, 16, 17 years old. I didn't have no money. I had a job, but I didn't, you know, I didn't work and have a lot to spend.
I gotcha.
On extra stuff. So as I got older, you know, I was able to incorporate more with the cash flow, obviously. And then seeing the results of, you know, just wearing a cover scent helped. So, okay, well, what happens if I do put the wind, you know, if the deer are coming from the north and, you know, I put my wind direction this way, they're not going to smell me until they're past me and hopefully they're bleeding by then.
Right.
So, and then I wasn't hunting mature deer, you know, in Southwest Pennsylvania, a mature deer was not very old. You know, you
two
didn't
years old, 3 years old,
three years older. That was back then was a big deer. It was an aged deer. So I was used to like, it's brown, it's down, you know, okay. Basket rack, 6 points and four.
That's a tri-state area thing, though. You know, like tri-state can, you know, when I refer to tri-state, I'm referring to New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, you know, but that tri-state area just seems like that was the culture of, you know, the last 50 years up until about 10 years ago of if it's brown, it's down. And there was no question. You got criticized more for letting a deer walk than shooting a younger deer. You know, if you can give me 30 seconds, I got to go take a leak real quick and then we'll continue this up.
All right. I'm going to go grab a drink. So
yep. Do your thing, man. Grab a beer. Yep. If you want.
You're good. We're on a break. We need. Oh, I haven't seen them bad boys.
All right. Whenever you good.
Yeah.
All right. It sounds to me like the early years for hunting, you kind of had somebody, like you said, you kind of jumped on their coattails, your neighbor, and kind of followed in their footsteps. And then after the first couple of years, they kind of told you the what or the how, but not so much the why. They said, okay, this is the oak flat. This is the area you want to be. Now you're going to go ahead and pick a tree. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't.
Right.
From that point, what was the transition like for you from they're going to tell me the why or the what to it's up to me now to figure out where to go, where to sit, where not to sit, so on and so forth. So basically, what was the transition from kind of having that crutch, for lack of a better way to, for lack of a better phrase, to kicking off the training wheels and saying, okay, now it's all up to me?
It was like mass chaos. Everything I did, I second thought myself. You know, if I sat in a tree for an evening and like notoriously there's deer that come through here. I mean, there's feed, there's trails, there's bedding areas over there. Like, why am I not seeing deer? Is it because I'm wide open? Can they see me? Am I not concealed enough? Is my wind wrong? And I'm just not catching it. It's like I constantly second question myself, and I still do that to this day. I second whenever things aren't going how I think they should be in the woods. Yeah. I'm like, what did I screw up now? You know, kind of thing. But as I got older, I learned to trust a few things. And as I got older, my buddy Ron, you know, we would have sit down and have these conversations like you and I are having, you know. He's like, look, you've got to trust your camouflage. You've got to trust your placement of your tree stand. If you don't trust what you've done to that point, no matter what you see, you know, no matter what you do, it's not going to be good enough. So, you know, maybe I did do everything right that night that I didn't see any deer. They just wasn't in that neck of the woods that day, you know.
Right.
You know, they don't have a schedule.
No way to know.
Yeah, they don't have a schedule. You know, it was before trail cameras, so it wasn't like you could have, you know, 20 trail cameras out like guys do now, which, you know, I don't know. I have mixed emotions about trail cameras and all that stuff too. So
It's all,
I love them, but yeah, I hate them.
Yeah, I think it's all in the way you use them. I think it comes down to ethics at that point. You know, if I was sitting at work and I saw a big deer show up on camera and it was 2 hours before I'm ready to go hunting, I'm probably going to go hunt that camera. Like I'm not going to lie, but does that make me an unethical hunter? Is that the same as saying I'm sitting at work and a camera shows up and I tell my boss I'm leaving and go and sit in that tree? You know, I don't know, man. You know, that line of ethics when it comes to trail cameras, specifically cell cameras, because if you're using a non-cell camera, I think that you're really doing inventory. You're putting in a little bit more work. I think there's some space for that. I think it's the cell cameras where things become just a little bit hairy.
Like, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's all about how you use the information. Like me, we have a property in New York. My family's got property in upstate New York. We can't be there all the time. The only way to truly scout for us outside of hunting season is to have cell cameras. And it allows us to gather data. We put together a database. We start to figure out what times of the year are good, what times of the year aren't. In that case, I don't think there's any problem with that. But again, back to the description I gave a few minutes ago is, if I'm sitting at work and all of a sudden I get a picture and I'm calling out of work now and I'm going to sit that stand, the fair chase is gone.
Right.
And I think that's where that line is.
We're almost at 100% green up in the mountains of New York, which means the majority of the country is in spring or summer food plot mode. If you're in the market for some seed this year, you have to make sure the Vitalize seed is on your list. Whether you're running a traditional system or a no-till system, they've got you covered with products like annual clover, clover plus with chicory, or their 1-2 punch of nitro boost in the summer and carbon load in the fall. They've also got natural amendments to help give your food plots and seeds the boost they need to thrive. More important than that, Vitalize Seeds' focus starts with the soil to help solidify your plots for years to come. So whether you're looking for some seed this warm season or simply looking for some answers to your questions, head on over to VitalizeSeed.com to find your solutions.
Well, you know, I have a really close friend of mine. He's a big deer killing machine. He murders deer, and he murders some really nice deer. Ohio, Kentucky. I mean, he lays them down. And I worked with him directly for about 4 years. And that man, I say man, he's young. He's a lot younger than I am. But he has kids, so like, and he has work, so he maximizes his time through that cell camera. Like, if he's like Jeremy, he's like, dude, I've got this stud 180, he's on camera 3 days in a row. I'm going to take Friday off. I'm like, fair. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's cool. You know, it's not impeding in your work schedule, whatever, blah, 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 blah. And notoriously, that time of year for us in the natural gas field and transmission specifically, that time of year is kind of starting to wind down, all your summer projects are ending. So, you know, you do have some downtime to take off. And you don't know how many times he's taken off, though. Take that Friday off, hunt Friday, Saturday, Sunday, call into work, be like, hey, I'm going to take Monday off. All 4 days, never seen the deer, not one time. All the weather conditions were the same. The pressure wasn't up, wasn't down. You know, wind wasn't crazy. It just, that deer just didn't, he showed up for 3 days and that was it. Or he showed up for 2 days and that was it. So, you know, that's, I understand that part of it. It's just, I know of some folks that, like, they use that as, it's a tool, but they use it in a negative way. You know, any tool can be used in a negative way, regardless of what it is. 100%. So it's not that I oppose them or I despise them, because I've used trail cameras for a long time. I haven't put trail cameras out. I'm looking at a pile of them sitting over there behind this camera that I haven't used in a couple years. One, because I haven't hunted much back here in the East in the past couple years. So I haven't really had time to take inventory or worry about, you know, what deer I had on the landscape at the time. It was just like, if I'm going in the woods, I'm going in the woods. And if I see a buck that trips my trigger, whether it's 110 inches or 180 inches, I'm going to kill it. Yeah. Same with the doe. I was wearing a shirt to work the other day, and I got it from Red Arrow, Kip Campbell. You know, I've got 99 problems, but killing does ain't one.
Yeah, I love that.
If you need does killed, call Jeremy, because I'll come and I'll slaughter as many as you want.
That's amazing.
I love to eat deer meat. I eat it. We had deer tacos last night for dinner, and we're having deer burgers tonight for dinner. So
I had a deer steak last night, and I got a little piece of a backstrap sitting on the stove right now defrosting. So
right, you know, a lot of guys, you know, they'll kill bucks, and they're done. You know, I'm like, man, that sucks. What happens? You kill your buck on the damn first day of archery season, then you're screwed the rest of the year. I don't kill those. I'm like, well, your loss, my gain.
Yeah.
You know, so. You know,
I got to be honest, last year, so I told you, my wife and I just moved to PA last year. Mm-hmm. And I did not, to my own fault, I didn't look into the regulations enough to realize that Pennsylvania doesn't give you a doe tag. You get one buck and you have to buy your doe tags or whatever. I didn't realize that. So by the time hunting season came around, there were no doe tags left. And I was literally left hunting brand new ground with barely any information, completely different terrain, literally miles upon miles of woods, which is completely opposite of what I grew up hunting. Where I grew up hunting, yeah, there were woods, but there were houses kind of scattered around. There were pockets of woods versus vast forest. Hunting last year for me became very discouraging when I got out and I was seeing a couple doe, but I really wasn't seeing bucks. I didn't see a single buck last year in Pennsylvania, to the point where I stopped. I lost the drive to get out in the woods, which is awful for me to say. But if I wasn't seeing anything I could legally shoot, and it was getting frustrating and annoying that I couldn't shoot what I did see. So I just focused on New York, which was, you know, I shot a doe with a rifle. I missed a doe, hit a doe, but didn't recover with the bow. So I had opportunities, but for me, it was very, very frustrating. It was new territory, which is something I want to get into with you, because you grew up hunting here in Pennsylvania. But before we get there, I want to know, what was that turning point for you? So you grow up, you have this mentor that you're hunting with. They're kind of giving you a little bit, but not the full picture. They taught you everything you know, but not everything they know, type of deal, right? So now you start going out on your own. You start second guessing everything, every decision you make, you're questioning yourself. What was that turning point, that light bulb moment where you said, shit, I actually got this?
Right.
Can you think back to that moment or that hunt or when that was, or have you not reached that yet?
I don't know that light bulb's been fully lit.
It's flickering.
It's sporadic, but in all seriousness, it seems like the validation that I kind of had a gist of what I was doing was when I put the first one on the ground by myself. Mm-hmm. No outside anybody giving me any heads up of, hey, maybe you need to try this. But it's when I went into a woods, and honestly, it was, I remember it vividly. It was right down the road. It was maybe 10 minutes from here. It was up on a road up here in the mountain. I'm not going to say where it was at, but I was on public ground, and I just had the afternoon to hunt. I got off of work early. You know, I was still in high school, so I got off work. I was on work study. So I got off work and I worked till like 3 o'clock, and I was like, I'm heading up the mountain. So I get up here and I had nowhere in mind that was close enough that I could get to and still have time to enjoy a hunt. So I just go up on this one road and I'm driving. And I look over, I said, yep, that looks good. I pulled over. I threw my tree stand on my back and I started walking. And then, you know, I came to a spot and I was like, this will work. And I just put my shit down, climbed up a tree, pulled it up, sat down, and about, I don't know, 5-10 minutes before dark, out busted a herd of, well, I say a herd, but 6, 7, 8 does come out into the open woods from the thicket. And me being anxious, still young, not knowing what I was doing, not knowing what was happening. First big doe that walked in front of me, I blasted her. She ran, she fell over up towards the road, which was good for me because I didn't have that far of a drag. Still had a pretty good drag, but not as far. And not using my my knowledge that I gained from all those old timers. Well, whenever you see a bunch of does bust out of a thicket, you might just want to wait a minute or two.
Yeah.
Because they're probably, there's probably making them, something making them bust out of the woods, out of that thicket. Well, I whack her and I sit down and I look and there's a buck right in front of me. I'm like, you gotta be shitting me. So that was when the light bulb went off to know I was doing things in the correct manner.
Okay. Do you remember driving down the road? Do you remember what it is that you saw that made you say, yeah, this spot will work? Like, what was it, a terrain thing? Was it a cover thing? Like, talk to me a little bit about what set you off.
It was a pull off on an old country road. That's it.
Easy. So it was just an easy access.
Yeah, it was just, there was a wide enough spot to fit my vehicle in. I just whipped it in there and got my shit out and went. And once I got there, I mean, it's mountain land, and I kind of knew the area, but I never really hunted it. But I knew it enough that what features I typically look for were going to be there somewhere, you know, in a 20-minute walk, I was going to find something that was going to suffice and work out for me.
Yeah.
As far as in my brain, work out for me to where I could sit and feel comfortable.
Right. Now at that time, I know we're going back a little bit, but at that time when you said the features that would work for you at that time, what features were you looking for? Was it a feed tree thing? Was it a terrain thing? What were you looking for in those earlier years hunting by yourself?
At that time of year, I remember vividly, it wasn't the rut yet, but it was working that way. It was getting there. And I was like, these deer are probably going to be trying to stack up on food until, because when the rut hits, you know, they're going to be getting run all over this damn mountain. I was like, so I'm going to look for a nice feeding area close to a thicket because they're going to want to stay tight because it's getting close. So, and luckily the wind was in my favor. What I found, I was like, money. And
right,
that's how. So that
at the time, you had done everything right to locate a buck and just didn't realize that you made all the right moves.
Yeah.
And premature. Now, I don't want to say prematurely, because obviously the doe got your blood pumping. You were excited to take the doe. It doesn't sound like you regret taking that doe. But in hindsight, with the knowledge you have now, it sounds like you probably would have let those doe walk and see what was coming out behind them. Or maybe not.
Maybe. I don't know. It depends. It really depends. Because, you know, also a wise words from my buddy Ron. He's like, whenever you're sitting in a tree stand and a deer's sitting in front of you, if your foot starts to go crazy, you better kill it.
Yeah.
And it could happen to me. I still feel like I'm getting jitters right now. Like,
thinking about it. Yeah.
I get so worked up. It doesn't matter if it's a doe. It doesn't matter if it's a 100-inch whitetail or 140, 150-inch whitetail, because I've never killed a 150-inch whitetail. I killed on, you can't see them outside the pictures, they're 2 140s that are my pride and joy.
That one you showed me earlier, man, over your, I think it's your right shoulder. That deer was beautiful. Nice, tall, I want to say, I say basket because it's tight, but it's tight and tall, man. That deer looks beautiful. This one over my shoulder is my biggest to date and the only one that is bigger than, I mean, I have this guy here, which was the first buck ever shot on our private property. So I got this guy. My first deer ever was a little four pointer with my uncle, which honestly, I got to tell you, of all the deer I've ever shot, that deer with my uncle, my very first deer, has to be still to this date my favorite, simply because we were hunting in a place where my grandfather used to hunt. And by the time I started hunting, he was no longer with us, you know, and it was just a moment with a family member. My uncle is the reason why we hunt. My dad, my listeners know this, so I'll just give you the brief version of it. But my dad wasn't grown up. He didn't grow up hunting. My mom talked him into going hunting with her brother, my uncle. You know, so he got into hunting in 1990. I was born 1991. So in my brain, I grew up in a hunting family, but I didn't really grow up in a hunting family. Right. You know, I just grew up with an uncle who hunted. Same thing like you. He would put us in a specific area, wouldn't tell us why or what we were doing here. He would just put us somewhere. So when it came time for me to hunt, I was like, oh yeah, man, I've shot plenty of deer. I got this. And then all of a sudden it was like, I got amnesia and I'm just starting from scratch, you know? But so you had this light bulb moment. You're driving down the road. You find this easy pull off. Once you get in there, you start looking for some specifics. Let's fast forward now to, I guess, current times, last 10 years. How have things changed for you? How have you taken what you learned in the past, both from those early wet behind the ears years, then into the I'm starting to figure stuff out, into now you are a respectable killer? So what have you taken from those early years into now that have kind of said, okay, this stuff that I did when I was young, this was the right way to do it. This is what I need to look for. But also, I don't know why the hell I did that shit back then. I'm never doing that again. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, so I got kind of a unique story. I said I was in Ohio. I said I was in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. You could feed deer during hunting season, both of those states.
Yes.
So when I went to those states.
New Jersey as well, by the way. Yeah. We should throw that out there.
Well, when I was in New Jersey, where I lived, I still lived in Pennsylvania when I worked in New Jersey. I lived over in, Bucks County.
Okay.
So, you know anything about that part of Pennsylvania, there's, you know, a couple million-dollar homes on a quarter-acre lot, and they were everywhere where I lived.
Yeah.
But getting back to the, you know, what works, is when I moved to Kentucky, Ohio, that was like all of the corn piles everywhere. You know, you could see them from fucking Google Earth. You know, you'd find corn piles, right? And so I got away from my foundation of, you know, hunting, you know, funnels, raws, eating areas, you know, flats, feeding oak flats, you know, natural travel corridors. I got away from all of that. And I went stupid. And I would just be like, this looks like a nice place. Here's 100 pound of corn.
Yeah.
You know, throw trail cameras on it. And I would see some really nice deer, but I'd go into the woods and I'd be hunting corn. I'm like, when them deer come into corn, boy, oh boy, them things are, they're like on meth. They're high. Yeah. They're looking everywhere. So, so I took a step back and started to really think about it, because I don't know how to hunt that way. I don't know how to hunt over corn. Like the Ohio boys, they're masters at it. You know, some of them are masters and they know exactly what to do. And I took some tips and tricks from them and it yielded a little bit of success, but it kind of felt, honestly, coming from Pennsylvania where none of that was legal, kind of felt like cheating, right?
Yeah.
So that buck, the buck that you didn't see, which is over here, I did have corn, but what I evolved to was, like, I would make sure when I set my trail cameras up on that corn, I would see, you know, I would get a real good visual of where they came in and where they left. Mm-hmm. So I was always good for getting when they left. That's where I always tried to set my tree stand up, on the direction they were going when they left that corn pile.
So, and over the corn, sorry to cut you off, you were using the corn more to figure out their pattern than it was to hunt them on the corn specifically.
You know, guys, in today's day and age, scents, lures, and attractants are a big part of our hunting experience. When it comes to choosing a product, we here at Wing and Tail look no further than Rack Getter Scents. At Rack Getter, you'll find unique, innovative, one-of-a-kind products that bring the deer in and keep them coming back for more. They also have products for bear, turkey, fish, and more. Most importantly, being a local small business, Gerard hand delivers every product to his dealers, so you know he's got his finger on the pulse. So if you're looking to up the odds this fall and you'd like to support a local small business while doing it, head on over to rackgettersense.net and check out what they have to offer.
And instead of going and just dumping it in a random place, I would go to my spots when I was growing up. Okay, they're working their way to this field, so I want to get them stopped and I want to see what it is. And then I'm going to get them before they get to the field, or I'm going to get them right as they get into the field. So I evolved that way. So I kind of went back to my roots on paying attention to travel corridors and, you know, terrain features, which, you know, everybody and their brother say the same thing. You know, you got to pay attention to all those things. And in Ohio, sometimes some of the land is kind of like here in Southwest Pennsylvania, not as big, but there's mountains, there's big hills, you know, there's steep, there's rock ledges, there's all of that stuff. But then there's also parts of Ohio that's really subtle and really flat. So, I mean, it's a depression in the ground, or it's a mound that's only 8 foot tall, 6 foot tall, and it's got a little saddle in it. And that saddle drops down to 3 feet. Well, the deer's going to, you know, from my experience, the deer's going to go through that saddle, and it's only a matter of feet. So I started using that part of my hunting tactics from back here, and when I was a kid and younger, to that, and it really helped. And the buck that you did see on this side, we had no corn that year. Like the last 4 years I hunted in Ohio, there was pretty much no corn. We just didn't hunt it. We kind of knew the lay of the land. We knew what was going on. We didn't need to take inventory because we knew what was there. And so that one, I grunted him in. That was a wild ride. And then the buck on this side that you haven't seen, he's got 12 and a quarter inch G3s on one side. So he's pretty nice. He's still a young deer. If I'd have left him go a couple of years, he probably would have been a dandy. But
sometimes it's hard to see those and let them go, you know?
Yeah.
So the progression of your hunting sounds like you went from, again, being told the areas to go to, then trying to figure it out on your own based on the little bit of woodsmanship that you have, then into, wow, this baiting thing is kind of cool. Let me do that. And then took a step back and then used both the baiting and the woodsmanship. In your experience, what style of hunting yields the best results? Baiting solely, woodsmanship solely, or using bait to direct deer and then using the woodsmanship on where to intercept them?
In a state like Ohio, Kentucky, I'd say a blend. I mean, a blend really, really works. I say really works, but your chances of frequency go up dramatically, you know. So that same caliber buck in Pennsylvania, he might be on this trail 2 days a week, but in Ohio, same trail, you know, same type trail, but there's a corn pile, his likelihood of being there is probably, you know, and not just because of the corn. That's one thing that I did learn. It's not because of the corn. It's because they're, instead of, you know, him seeing one or two does on his walk to the field, he sees 20 at this corn pile. He's like, hey boys, I know where I'm going.
So were those bucks going to the corn, or were they simply going downwind of the corn because they knew doe were going to be there? So basically what I'm getting at is, were the bucks gravitating to that area because they were scent checking for does, or were they going to that area for whatever bait that they were offered?
Early season, definitely they were going there to eat, you know.
Okay.
And I always try to put it into like a close proximity to water. When I say close, you know, within a couple hundred yards of water somewhere. So early season, I would say they were there for the protein. You know, when it come closer to the rut, when they're, you know, when they're starting to cruise, you didn't see them as much on camera. But if you were in a tree or nearby in a tree, you would see them in the area because they would, like you said, they would skirt the corn, come downwind, and then possibly maybe they would come in and take a bite. And I mean, it wasn't like, you know, there in the early season, those younger bucks, they'd come in and they'd lay right in the corn pile all night long. And they'd just lay there and get hungry. They reached out, take a bite. But during, like, when the time was right and the getting was good, they definitely wasn't, they wasn't worried about what was on the ground. They was worried about what was, you know, around that food that was on the ground.
So we're at the point now where you've now moved back to Pennsylvania. You've been in a couple states where you could bait. It sounds like even though you're in Pennsylvania, you've had some property to hunt in Ohio all along up until recently. But now you come back to a state where you're not allowed to bait. And now, I'll be honest, we're getting into the part of the conversation where I'm going to be a little selfish, because this is where I have now run into a wall myself. I have now reached the limit of my abilities, and I'm now trying to expand my ability to be more successful. My entire life, I have been really good at finding sign. I've been really good at finding deer. Once I moved to Pennsylvania, again, I've been able to find sign. I can look at a mobile app or a scouting app or whatever the case may be,
Mm-hmm.
And I can say, this is where I should be able to find sign. And I could walk into the woods and find sign, like, mm-hmm. relatively quickly. Mm-hmm. I cannot capitalize on that. I haven't been able to yet. Again, I'm used to hunting. A majority of my solo hunting growing up, the woods of northern New Jersey, again, my uncle had been hunting for years and years and years, and had these ideas of where to put us. And I'll be honest, part of me has avoided going back there because I have this complex where I want to do it myself. Mm-hmm. I'm being difficult and probably to my own detriment. So my brother and I found these other places to go. It's the same place where I shot this guy, but this guy was shot over corn. He came into corn, like you were saying, very weary, looking around. It took him like 45 minutes to walk 50 yards, you know. Mm-hmm. But since then, I've kind of gotten away from the bait, and I kind of want to do it on my own. Right. Again, maybe to my own detriment. So I say all this to say, in the mountains, vast mm-hmm. woods, like any mm-hmm. direction you look at, there's woods. Granted, in the state parks in New Jersey, I'm not used to this, but there are those 99-year leases everywhere you look, which is mm-hmm. completely different for me. That doesn't exist where I'm from. Mm-hmm. But I now have a problem with, how do I connect the sign I find to then intercept a deer? So right. how do you use – I don't even know if I want to go there. Let's start with, let's say you're forced to find the new place to hunt in Pennsylvania, whether your public land became private or it got too clustered and you want to go find somewhere else to hunt. You now have to go find the new place to hunt, mountainous mm-hmm. terrain in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about your very first steps. You're not even, obviously you're not going to waste your time going to walk if it doesn't look good on map. So when you're looking at, when you're e-scouting, breaking apart a brand new piece of property, deciding if you want to go there or not, what are some things that you're looking for as far as terrain or e-scouting features are concerned? What are you looking for that says this might be a place worthwhile or worth diving into a little bit farther?
I'm a terrible e-scouter.
Okay. Terrible. Which honestly terrible. Probably isn't a bad thing, because that means that you're more boots on the ground guy than you are tech, which is great. Like, but
whenever I do, you know, I have OnX. You know, and I use it mostly when I go out west. But like here back in Pennsylvania, I haven't looked at it really closely this year or even last year. But like if I'm walking into a new place, you know, I'm looking for, you know, and I did find out, and I found that out mostly out west, was the topo lines. They're not always right. They're not always right. Not even close sometimes. So I look for, you know, I try to look for something as simple as like a secluded field or water, like secluded water. If it's like an old little pond, or, you know, if you can find a creek that's running water, we run into this a lot out west too. You know, a lot of folks that like to hunt right off the road. And then the craze came, well, if there's a lot of folks hunting off the road, I'm going to go 10 miles deep. And then, you know, I'm like, well, what about everything in between? You know, you've got miles, you know, 1 through 9. What are you doing? You're just busting through it. So I don't necessarily like to hunt real close to the road, but I'm not afraid to go deep if I have to. But yeah, feature wise, I would say, you know, kind of secluded fields. And it doesn't have to be much of a field at all. If there's trees in it, but it's open and it's brushy, I know that's where deer are going to like to bed, kind of thing. And I know that's where the deer are going to be during the rut. Because you hunt these big, massive tracts of land, not like hunting New York or New Jersey, you know, where you're hunting a 15-acre plot or a 20-acre plot or 30-acre plot. You're hunting, you know, several thousand acres. It's, you know, that also, that spreads your deer out. So we may have more deer than the state of New Jersey. I don't know how that works. I'm not into that part of it. But as far as, you know, the deer on the landscape, you know, there just aren't as many because they're so spread out. You know, up here on the mountain, there's vast, vast amounts of public land to hunt on. Even the private land, there's guys that own, you know, a guy that lives right across the street from me. He owns like 340 some acres just right here. And then he owns another 700 over there. And so there are these big tracts of land. Honestly, if you could find that, that's another good one. You know, that would just hit me just by me saying it.
If you, was that getting like permission to hunt on larger tracts of land?
The chances of that happening are very slim to none, especially around here in this time of day. I'll do a name drop just because Levi Morgan, he owns property probably within 5 miles of my house. He owns 200 acres. So what's he do? He's got, you know, and kudos to him. I'm not busting on him, not one lick, because if I had the means to do it, I would too. He has turned his property into a deer haven.
Yes.
Who wouldn't? If you're a deer hunter, that's what you want to do with all the property you get.
Food plots and all that good
stuff. Right. So, yeah. And he's surrounded by a lot of public land. Where are those deer going to go? Where they feel safe. Mm-hmm. So one of the good things to do is, like, don't impede. I'm not condoning trespassing by no stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. But those deer aren't going to stay on that property all the time. They're going to venture out close to it. Close. Not, you know, look, there's a survey stake and there's a tree 5 yards away. I'm going to hunt in it. Probably not the brightest thing to do.
Yeah.
And I know people that do that, but I mean, you're taking the chance of that landowner saying, you know, I shot the deer on public land, but he ran onto your private land, you know. In Pennsylvania, I don't know how it works in Pennsylvania because I've never had to encounter it, but I know there are some states, like, the owner does not have to let you recover that animal.
Yeah.
He can let it sit out in the woods and rot.
I got to be honest with you. I'm not okay with that. You know, when I lived out in New Hampshire, the law was if the land was posted, you could not trespass. But if it was private property and it wasn't posted, it was fair game. Honestly, I think that's a fair way to go. I also think that it should be blanket. Now, this is just me, and I don't know what kind of problems this may cause. But I think every state should adopt that if you shoot a deer on public and it runs onto private, that if you call the game commission and you say, I shot the deer here and it ran here, that they should be able to give you at least the okay to go in and find your deer. Because what kind of standard are we setting if we say, nope, you can't go find your deer, just let it rot? Like, what are we doing? You know, and that's me going back to the roots of, like, my first bow kill was a button buck that I spined, and I watched him drag himself across the ground.
Right.
Till this day, that breaks my heart more than the deer I hit and didn't recover. Because I physically watched that deer suffer. I heard the sounds coming out of him. I put another shot into him. Now, what if you shoot a deer in the liver and it cannot go on living and it's suffering for a day or two? And that now property owner has not given you permission to go out and locate or recover that deer like that. I don't know. I also get the other side of people not wanting you to be on their property. What's theirs is theirs. I understand that completely. But oh man, that it's a really tough line to straddle, because both sides have a pro and a con.
Whether you're a competition archer stepping to the line in the finals, or a hunter drawing back on your personal best, you owe it to yourself and the animal to have the best functioning equipment out there. That's why when it comes to bow or arrow components, the Wing and Tail boys pick Fire Knock products every time. Every product they make is proven to outperform anything already on the market by 50% or more, and they have the science to back it up. They've even made it so easy to find the components specific to your arrow shaft with their Fire Knock Arrow Component Selector. If you're ready to up your equipment's performance today, check out fireknock.com.
Right.
So let's say I'm going to give you a specific scenario that I found last year. So correct me if I'm wrong, but these 99-year leases on Pennsylvania, technically, they're not private property. You could walk through their driveway. You could walk up their property. You just can't physically touch anything of theirs or go on their patio or whatever. Is that my...
I don't have a clue. Okay. I'm not going to lie to you.
This one spot, I drive down the road. It is nothing but mountain laurel. Like, you're driving down, you're driving, it's open. And all of a sudden, the woods are just thick with mountain laurel for like 2 or 3 miles down the road. And then it opens up again into like pine pasture or whatever you want to call it, pine stands. So I'm driving down the road one day, and I say, you know what, this is something worth checking out. So I park on the side of the road, I walk in, and I start following this trail, not following sign or anything. I'm just following a trail. And I see a rub here, I see tracks or whatever, and eventually I get to a spot where it's just a wall of laurel. Like, I physically can't get through it. So I turn around, I start walking back, and as I walk back, I pick up a rub line. okay, let me check this out. I'll keep following it. Next thing I know, I'm literally walking parallel to this river or to this stream. It's not a river. I'm walking parallel to this stream, and all of a sudden there is a rub literally every 3 to 5 feet. You cannot walk more than 10 feet without finding a rub in both directions. It was a dual directional rub line. Now, in my head, that's telling me that this is the buck's core area. He's traveling both directions. He's walking from bedding and to bedding. Which way is which? I don't know. This stretch just happens to be in between two big oak flats or two sections of oak trees with all mountain laurel and just wide open pine stands in between. I still haven't been able to locate this deer. I have not got him on camera. I haven't gotten eyes on him while hunting. Mm-hmm. But it's relatively flat throughout the area. How would you go about now dissecting this particular scenario?
It's like I said, I'm horrible with this, like on paper or on an app. But I would get out there and I would look for, you said it's relatively flat. I would look for the smallest of land feature, Like if it's just a foot or two, you know, start finding your, I'm not going to bet money because I'm a horrible gambler, but those rub lines, if there's a depression in the ground anywhere, I mean, just a couple feet, it's going to be right through that depression. Guaranteed. The rub lines are tough. They're tough. I mean, it's a real good indicator that the animals are there, but when are they making those rubs? You know, you don't know if they're doing it on their way in the morning, and if they're doing it, you know, before daylight and then after dark, you could sit there, you could sit on that rub line forever and never see that deer. So I would, and this goes back to my buddy giving me knowledge, was be cautious, but get close to that bed as you can without spooking, you know? And I mean, how close is that? That's totally up to your judgment.
Every deer is different.
Yeah. And I know like him, for instance, like he would get up pretty tight on thickets. We had lots of, we called them jagger thickets, but we had lots of them like on the other side, not up on this part of the mountain, but on another piece of property that we used to hunt. And he would get up tight on them, and he would get high enough in the tree to where he could see down into that thicket. And that's the way he hunted. And God, was he successful, especially like pre-rut, when they're just starting to cruise. That was always money for him. Stay tight to one or the other, bedding or food. And he always tended to stay tight to bedding. Because bedding, they could be up in that bedding just walking around, you know, and they feel safe because it's so damn thick, right?
Yeah.
But they may catch a whiff of something bad, or, you know, for some reason that deer is not wanting to leave the security of that thicket until after dark. Well, you can sit on the food plot you can sit on the food source all you want. You'll see deer, but you're probably not going to see that deer that you're targeting, you know. And it's without trail cameras, it's hard to tell, you know, what's what. Is it, you know, I've seen little bucks make some damn nice rubs. And I've seen some really, really nice bucks make some really shitty rubs. So, you know, and I've seen the property that we hunted, you would catch a rub every now and again, but rubs weren't a huge thing. Scrapes, that's a different ball game. They would scrape everywhere. I mean, all over. There'd be scrape. There was no rhyme or reason. It was like there'd be one there, one back there, one over here. There was no scrape line. It was just they were everywhere on top of these flats. Mm-hmm. And so it's really hard to. It's really, really hard. And I'm not always the best at, you know, pinpointing exactly where I'm going to intercept that deer. I typically, and they always say, you know, the best time to kill a deer is the first time you see it. That's not true, because that's how that one died. Mm-hmm. I seen him 1 week, and it was actually the week after my buddy had left. So it was the 1st of November, you know, right around the 1st of November somewhere. And he walked out, and he's out into the field, and I ranged him, and my rangefinder went dead. And I was like, I'm not shooting him because I didn't step nothing off. Mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, God didn't give me rangefinder eyes. I'm terrible at it. And I found that out through shooting 3Ds. I was terrible at it. Never caught the hang of it. The next week, you know, that night I called my buddy. I was like, I blew it. I was like, it's game over. I said, that big buck's, I saw him, I'll never see him again. And he said, don't get down on yourself. You'll see him again. Well, that Tuesday, It was a Tuesday. I went out for an evening hunt, made sure I had new batteries in my rangefinder. Lo and behold, he walked out the same damn trail and I stuck him at 34 yards. So,
okay. And that's honestly, that whole scenario that you just played out is the exact mm-hmm. reason I switched over to the Garmin site. I use the Garmin yeah. rangefinding site because mm-hmm. it's just, there's so many variables that can go wrong. And I make yeah. sure that those, I always have a spare battery with me. Not that would make a difference in the moment, mm-hmm. you know, but I shoot my bow enough to know if that sight is going to go dead or not, mm-hmm. you know. Now, whenever you go out in the woods, the big thing is find the limiting factor. There are three things deer need to survive: food, water, cover. Find the limiting factor. Well, here's the problem. Between the road and the water is about, I would say, somewhere between 70 and 100 yards. And the water parallels the road. All mountain laurel. All perfect bedding. On the other side of the water, like I said, two separate massive oak flats. Mm-hmm. Plenty of food. With mm-hmm. a river, stream, brook, whatever you want to call it, running through the middle. Plenty of water. There's no limiting factor. So
what you might be in is what they call the sanctuary, you know. You're in that deer's house. Like, everything is within, you know, a couple minute walk. So that deer, you know, that's his comfort zone. Mm-hmm. He knows when something's wrong. You know, I'm a very firm believer in killing a buck is a very hard thing to do. And they don't live to be 5, 6, 7, 8 years old by being stupid. They're pretty damn smart. So they know when something's, especially if that's their house. You know, they know if something's wrong. They know something don't quite smell right. You know, they know something quite, you know, looks a little off. They know that. So my first thought would be best time to kill them would be on the outside of the bedding areas during the rut would be my best.
Just outside, you know, that mountain laurel.
Because you're really getting into his, you know, and you hear this a lot. I believe Rod White, he's a big buck killing. And I know probably a lot of your listeners already know that, but he's a big buck killing public land freaking machine. He always talks about like the sanctuary. You know, you don't ever go into the sanctuary. You go into the sanctuary, you fuck everything up. So, you know, I'm a firm believer in that. I don't know that I've ever found that. Like, I've never come across the perfect storm of feeding, bedding, and water. I've never come across it in a close proximity like that.
Yeah. And I just stumbled on it. Like I said,
yeah.
So the thing for me is I'm a teacher and my school is within the state park. Like, it's literally smack in the middle of the state park. So I get out of work, I drive a mile or two down the road and I can hunt anywhere from there, between there and my house, basically.
Gotcha.
So all of my hunting is afternoon. There's a chance that it could be morning sign. Who knows? But mm-hmm. the fact that it's going both ways tells me it's probably both morning and evening. Like, mm-hmm. that deer is in there. Now mm-hmm. this summer, my biggest problem in all of my years of hunting is I fall on the first sign I find rather than mm-hmm. saying, this is a great sign. What lies beyond it? Mm-hmm. So this summer, I found the sign last year. I didn't find a deer. So this year I went in, I decided to go a little farther. I literally walked 30 yards farther than I walked last year and found a massive community scrape that's still open in the summer. Not a single pine needle, not a single leaf, nothing in it. I put mm-hmm. a camera on it. I've gotten a couple doe and a fawn here or there, and actually a bear walking through the spot a little bit. But mm-hmm. it's on the opposite side of the water of where I found the rub line. The rub line mm-hmm. is really heavy on one side, and the community scrape is on the other. So something, for whatever reason, is telling me that that rub line is downwind of the predominant wind of where that community scrape lies. Again, I have nothing to confirm this, but
right.
based on what the sign that I'm finding, this is mm-hmm. what it's telling me. So I think I was in the right spot. I just didn't hunt it on the right days, or maybe I hunted it too late because he had already laid that sign. So something mm-hmm. tells me this year, I need to get into that spot like the second week of October and just get in there and hit it.
Right. Right. And I mean, honestly, there's only really one way to find that out. Unless to get your ass in a tree stand somewhere, right? And people were always like scared to like, oh, I'm gonna blow this deer out. Oh well, it's not the only white-tailed deer on this mountain.
Yeah.
It's not the only white-tailed deer on this farm.
No, and there's something to be said about bumping a deer, seeing where he goes, and then setting up where he goes. Mm-hmm. You know, I think they call it the bump and dump. method, essentially. So you, let's say, again, you're out here, you're scouting a new piece of property, you know, you're getting out for the first time, you're looking for some places to either drop a stand or to drop a camera. What type of sign? Actually, completely different scenario. Let's say somebody, you know, God were to reach his hand down now and say, Jeremy, you can only hunt one type of sign for the rest of your hunting career. What type of sign are you honing in on for the rest of your life? Like, what sign do you prioritize over anything else?
Food.
Mass food, crop food, browse, what type of food?
Food. Whether it be an acorn, an oak stand, whether it be a cornfield, whether it be a soybean field, you know, corn and soybean fields, those are kind of, well, soybeans not as hard, but hunting cornfields can be a real pain in the ass, especially standing corn.
You can't see shit.
You can't see shit and they don't come out. That's right. Rarely ever do they come out.
Because they got food and cover in the same place. Two out of three ain't bad, as Meatloaf once said.
So the best thing to do in that case is be there the day the farmer's cutting.
Okay.
Because then all hell breaks loose.
Yes.
But I would have to say food.
Okay. I want to give you a chance to talk. I mean, we've been here for like an hour 15 and change with the bathroom break or whatever, but yeah. I want to give you
a chance. I may have to take that bathroom break here in just a second.
I want to give you a chance to plug your X-Ring Custom Arrows here in a second, but is there anything throughout this conversation that we haven't touched on as far as either who you are as a hunter, tactics, anything that we didn't touch on that you think is pertinent to our listeners?
For me, yes. I do think that's my new addiction.
What's that?
And that's a bull elk, Mano days.
Okay. Here in PA, no. Bull elk or west?
Good luck with that. No, I've hunted out west for 5 years. This will be my fifth year out there. And I have not had success. I've had many encounters. And I say me, but it's not me. It's me and my hunting partner. He lives in Ohio. And we brought a third guy along with us last year, another one of buddy ours. And I screwed the pooch and shot over the back of an elk at 61 yards. May have been a little heavy on the trigger and misaligning a slider sight. Combination. I shot one right over its back at 61 yards, and it was, for the area, it was a really nice bull. And I was about ready to wrap a Matthews lift around a tree. But elk hunting is to me, you know, I won't hunt a turkey to save my life. I hate chasing turkeys.
Really?
Like, I'm not getting up at 3 o'clock in a damn morning to chase a 20-pound bird around this fucking mountain. But you wake me up at 3 o'clock in the morning to go chase a bugle. Every day of the week. If you could give me 30 days of September out west with a bow in my hand and an elk tag in my pocket, I will give up deer hunting today. Really? 100%. Oh yeah. It's wow.
Is that because it's something new? Is it because you've had your love affair with the deer and it's something new that sparks your interest? Or
no, because you know, white tail deer
for elk.
I would trade out my deer for elk. And it's not because whitetail deer is old, you know, it's just, you know, it's like played out because I love deer. I love deer hunting, but just the whole thing of elk, it's like you get to hear them just like a turkey, but they're 600. They move like the damn wind. If you think you can catch a deer walking or an elk walking, you're sadly mistaken. But just the, and it's the culmination of everything. You know, I'm out there, we're out there, you know, me and my buddies, it's like it's teamwork. It takes teamwork. I'm a huge teamwork kind of guy. And you're making, whether you're sitting around a campfire at nighttime, you know, bullshitting in the tent, you know, on your way, you know, to kill some damn grouse because you can't see no elk or you ain't hear no elk, whatever the case may be, it's an adventure, you know? Yeah. When I'm deer hunting, you know, usually very rarely do you see many people, you know, nowadays staying, sleeping in a tent, you know, on the side of the road to go hunting the next morning. Out there, you know, we've got bougie the last 2 years. We rented a cabin and its sole purpose is that every couple of days we can go take a nice shower, get a nice hot meal and, you know,
the shower is nice.
I sleep on the couch. So I really don't get a nice, comfortable sleep, but it's better than laying on the ground.
It still beats a cot.
no cots involved. Last year we have, and hopefully maybe one of these days we can go over kind of like what I take out there. It's pretty sparse, not very much, but just everything out there is, it's one thing. It's absolutely breathtaking to just walk out on top of a mountain at, you know, I think the highest we've been the past 2 years was 12,600 feet. So you get out on top of that mountain and it's like a different world. You know, you get to really enjoy this. I want to get a little sappy, I guess, but you really get to enjoy what God put us on this earth for, is like, yeah, sit there and just enjoy the view. I mean, I could sit out there and just stare at mountains and clouds and, you know, you name it, call me weird, but I could just sit out there and enjoy that. You know, it's wild.
I get you. My wife and I, we went on our honeymoon to Lake Tahoe, and we spent mm-hmm. a day or two in Sacramento and then drove up the coast of the Lake Tahoe up into I guess they call it a state line, which was the divider between Nevada and California. And then we went on, you know, a horseback ride, and we drove up the entire east coast of Lake Tahoe all the way to the northern shoreline. And it was just breathtaking. The views were just absolutely gorgeous. And then flying over the Rocky Mountains, it was like, I can only imagine, like, the view from, you know, a bird's eye view from the top was gorgeous. I could only imagine what it would be like to stand on the peak and to see everything out at, you know, face value.
Yeah, it's
that would just
be cool. You know, I spent a lot of time in the woods and a lot of night in the woods. In the Marine Corps, I spent lots of time out in the wilderness, you know, at dark. But there's something to be said when you're 6 miles deep and there's no interfering light impedance from a street light or a house lamp or anything. It's when it's dark, it's dark. And them stars are just so freaking bright and shining. It's absolutely wild. I love it.
I can only, yeah. Like, dude, like moving out here, I can see the difference. You know, out in New York where we have the property, there's still people around. There are still lights. And the sky is just, you wouldn't believe that it's the same sky that you see here. But then you go out west where there's literally not a single ounce of light pollution anywhere. I can only imagine what that would be like. Like that's breathtaking.
It's wild.
The thought is breathtaking. Dude, we got to get together. We got to get together. 100%. I know we're on opposite sides of the state and it can take like 6 hours to drive from end to end. But yeah, dude, we got to get together, boots on the ground, and do a little sit or something.
Oh, yeah.
Before we wrap this up, give the listeners a little a little sneak peek at what you do on the side, X-Ring Custom. We are both dealers for FireKnock. We both build arrows with FireKnock technology and FireKnock product. Give the listeners a little rundown of how long you've been in business and what you do.
So I've owned X-Ring since 2000. I opened the doors in 2016. I first started out, you know, I was pretty narrow in what I did. You know, I only had, and they hang out with, they've hung in with me to this day, which was Black Eagle and Victory arrows. So those were the only two arrows that I could get my hands on because I was a dealer for them. So that's all I built off of. And I was strictly, you know, FireKnock and a lot of higher dollar builds. But as the years progressed, you know, I branched out and, you know, I picked up some accessory line stuff and bowstrings. When I've had a couple different manufacturers of bowstrings that I've dealt with, started doing some bow tuning and bow work just on the side, nothing crazy, by appointment only. You know, I never had, you know, a shop to open. It's always been in my basement, no matter where I lived. And my sole thing is consistent precision arrows, not box store, you know, six pack blazer vanes, you know, and I want to deliver an arrow that is a hot rod. It's a performance based, maybe not the fastest arrow, but it's going to be, effective. It's going to be, very efficient. So that's kind of like where I like to, put my energy mostly.
Pun intended. I like what you did there.
Put I'm sorry.
I said, pun intended. I like what you did there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and, you know, here lately I've got some custom rafts that I tend to use. I've never picked up a broadhead line just because we talked about before we started the online thing here. There's just so much out there and the variety is so large that there's no way. And I've had shops in three different cities now. My shop has been in three different cities or towns, and the niche for the broadhead has been different in every single town. It's crazy. So like Southern Ohio, use a Rage guy. If you're in, you know, up north in Ohio, there was a lot of Exodus, the NAP Exodus. That was a big broadhead up there. Mm-hmm. And here, I haven't figured it out yet, but I'm assuming it's probably going to be a mechanical of some sort.
We were talking earlier before this recording, and there are so many variables that go into, like, how do I put it? You can use any shaft and build a good arrow. You can use,
for the most part,
maybe less, but there's still a large variety of vanes that you can use and build a good arrow. There are different levels of FOC that you can build and have an arrow that does its job. Mm-hmm. But there is not one broadhead. Like, what works for one, what broadhead works on one arrow build isn't going to work on another arrow build. Like, the broadhead has to be so specific to the individual using it. You know, like we were talking at the beginning of this episode, and I have pushed my setup to its absolute limit, to the point now where my arrow is flying so fast and spinning at such a high RPM that my broadhead, my options are so narrow that I don't have an option that I'm comfortable with. So now I don't know what to do. We had the conversation earlier, and I'll figure it out, man. But that's part of why I love that. That's part of why I love this. It's like you said, it's like a hot rod. You know, what tires work on one vehicle aren't going to work on another. I always go back to, I was blown away when I found out that Dodge Vipers came with basically treadless tires, because those are performance tires. But you need tread to drive on the road. Like, what? You know, so it's just like, if you put those tires on an F-150, it would be disastrous.
Right.
You know, so it's the same concept. You know, what vanes work for one person isn't going to work for another. What broadhead works for one person isn't going to work for another. And that's really important. And I think that's why it's so important to find a custom arrow builder, whether it's you or me or another Fire Knock dealer or somebody who isn't affiliated with Fire Knock whatsoever. The best thing you could do is get a quality custom builder to build an arrow for you, not to tell you what arrow is best. You know, that's how I see it. So where can listeners find you? If listeners are looking either to find out a little bit more about Jeremy Martin, or listeners want to find you to get an arrow built, where can they find you for either?
I have Instagram, Facebook. You could find me under Jeremy Martin at Facebook. I also have a Facebook page for X-Ring Custom Arrows. The same thing on Instagram, and it's xrcarrows.com, but it's pretty much going to lead you to a custom build page, and that email comes directly to me. I answer it the best I can with the information that I'm given. And, you know, I like to talk to my customers. There's been times I've had 2-hour long conversations. I've had 30-minute conversations just about arrows and what it takes to have consistency and this and that. So I like to speak to my folks, my customers, and the guys and girls that are willing to spend the money that it, you know, that these arrows cost. I feel I deserve, or they deserve, my interaction.
Yeah.
And I just try to be available to talk to all of my customers if they want to.
For sure. And I think it's important to state, now, granted, you know, if you go into Lighted Knox or a specific customer wants a specifically higher end shaft or a more expensive shaft, that changes things a little bit. But I have found, now that I have become a custom, you know, arrow builder myself, I've actually found that there are some combinations of custom arrows that we can build that are cheaper than if somebody were to go out and just buy a set of arrows off the shelf and build them themselves. You know, so a custom arrow doesn't need to break the bank.
No.
It can break the bank. Don't get me wrong. It can.
Yeah, it can.
But it doesn't have to. And you can still get the same benefits from it that you would from a higher end stuff.
Right.
So I say that to say, don't be afraid to reach out to me. Don't be afraid to reach out to Jeremy or custom arrow builder of choice. Just have a conversation.
You know? And if they're telling you have to shoot You know, I'll use a victory. You know, if you got to shoot the rip TKO
elite
or nothing, then that's probably not the guy you want to build your arrows. Anyways, you know, I'm honest. I'm straightforward. If the guy wants to shoot an elite, you know, 1,000 straight in the shaft, if he comes into the conversation knowing that he wants an elite shaft, which is a 1,000 straightness, he knows the price tag behind it. Mm-hmm. But if it's just, you know, Jimmy from down the street wants a batch of hunting arrows that he's going to shoot 30 yards at, I'm not going to sell him a $300 dozen arrows. I'm going to sell him, you know, a nice build that's going to do what he wants it to do at, you know, 30, 40 yards.
Exactly.
So
it's the same thing with car sales, man. You go to buy a car, you know, will a 1998 Nissan Sentra get you to work and back 100%? Will a Corvette also do the same thing, a little bit flashier? 100%. Which kind of guy are you? You know, and as the salesman or as the dealer, we got to give the customer what's best for them, not what's best for us.
And that's kind of where I sometimes use the analogy of, you know, guys shoot groundhogs with 22 Winchester, 22 longs and 22 Winchester mags. Or you can shoot it with a 338 Lapua. What do you want to shoot it with? I mean, it's up to you. So,
I hear you. Yeah. So Jeremy, this conversation was great, man. You know, we've been in touch a lot. We did a episode not too long ago with Dorch. It hasn't posted yet, where we talked about Arrow Concept 1.0, a little bit on 2.0. And for the listeners, this episode is going to drop before that one, because I'm just not to the end of the Science of Arrow Flight series yet. But for the listeners, there's a lot of value in that episode. But Jeremy and I go a little bit beyond or before that conversation. We didn't talk about it in this episode, but I bought a set of arrows from you like about 3 years ago now. And you are the reason that I believe in Fire Knock products today. You really are. You know, I heard a conversation that you had with, oh my goodness, why can't I think of it? Exodus, the dude from... Cameron Durr from Exodus. Mm-hmm. And I heard that conversation. I said, nope, I need those arrows. And I was the guy that needed the Corvette back in the day. Now I realize that we can use Fire Knock technology, maybe not on the same shaft or maybe save a couple bucks here or there. But at the end of the day, I always knew you for what you offered as far as product and arrow build and knowledge. But I'm really thankful that we had an opportunity to sit down and talk. And I kind of got to know you for Jeremy Martin, not X-Ring Custom. So I want to thank you for joining me on the episode today and giving me your time. We've spent significantly more time on this than I thought we would today, but it was a good conversation. I think it got you back in touch with a little bit of the you know, your roots, you know, got you back in touch with your roots, and it helped me out a little bit with maybe some of the things that I need to change in myself moving forward in this year. I want to thank the listeners for taking the time to join us today. You know, an hour and a half episode is not a little bit amount of time these days. So I want to thank the listeners for choosing to spend their day with us. And we have a little bit to offer. Guys, again, if you're looking to reach out to Jeremy, you can reach him at XR, what is it, XRC Custom?
XRC.com.
Fantastic. If you guys need anything, even if it's just a question and you don't end up buying anything, Jeremy is an awesome reference to go and speak to. If you're looking for some other stuff, if you guys are interested in a mobile setup, as y'all know, we just recently linked up with the Nested Tree Stand system. If you scroll down to the bottom of the description, there's a link there that'll take you to their website, but there's also a discount code that you can use, WT10, that'll save you 10% on your order. There are also the other supporters of the channel down below. Show them some love. They show us some love. They're great guys. We only partner with, never mind products that we believe in, we only partner with people we believe in. So I promise you that if you reach out to them, they're going to give you an experience that you can appreciate, enjoy, and love. With that being said, I got nothing else. Again, Jeremy, I want to thank you for your time. To the listeners, thank you for your time. And remember, success is just a commitment away. So until next week, have a great one, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks, Chris.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Spring break isn't what it used to be.
it's better. This spring, stay three nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
Ready to relax in your dream bath retreat without the stress of figuring out every detail yourself? At the Home Depot, your bath upgrade is covered. Shop fully designed rooms and curated bath collections to go from inspiration to transformation fast. Savings of up to 40% will make it easier on your budget. And find everything you need, from tubs to toilets and all the tile in between, to bring your vision to life. The Home Depot. Dream baths built here.
The world moves fast. Your workday, even faster. Pitching products, drafting reports, analyzing data. Microsoft 365 Copilot is your AI assistant for work. Built into Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and other Microsoft 365 apps you use. Helping you quickly write, analyze, create, and summarize. So you can cut through clutter and clear a path to your best work. Learn more at Microsoft.com/M365 Copilot.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.